It's time to take a look at your pet's health here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller, and pleased to have back Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. She comes by once a month to talk with us about pet health, and certainly you can join in with your own questions or comments. We're going to zero in on vaccinations to begin a bit, but questions for her, give a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, welcome back.
It is so nice to be here, Larry.
We've all heard of vaccinations. How do vaccinations work?
How do vaccinations work? Well, the way they work is you are giving either a modified version of the infective agent or part of the infective agent, depending if you're using something called a recombinant vaccine, that does not create disease, but tricks the immune system into thinking that I better respond to this, so that your immune system then mounts an immune response, so that future exposure to the real bug causes the immune system to kick in and prevent you from getting sick from many different diseases. And, you know, some of the myths out there about vaccines, probably the biggest one that I hear frequently.
Indoor cats?
Yeah. You know, I have a strictly indoor cat, never leaves the house. Why do I have to vaccinate them? And typically that cat is sitting on my exam table, and I just look at them and I say, well, whose cat is this? If your cat never leaves the house, then this must be an imposter, because you've just brought your cat into a facility where other cats are. And so that is one of the reasons why, you know, a strictly indoor animal is rarely ever indoors. Often they need to be hospitalized. In the case of dogs, they may have to go to the groomer. They may be going out in the backyard. Humans can bring viruses, especially there's some viruses that can live for a very long time in the environment. Cat disease called panleukopenia, also called cat distemper, or in the case of dogs, parvovirus, even some of the respiratory infections like the newer, although it's been around for some time now, canine influenza virus. Those can all be transmitted on clothing and bring them home, which is why everything I wear once and it goes in the wash. And it's like, I don't even, I kind of say hi to the dogs, disappear to the bedroom and get out of my clothes before they have a chance to greet me, because I don't want them, even though I wear a lab coat at work and I wash my hands between every patient and use hand sanitizer, there's always that possibility that I could be bringing something home.
So one of the things that we've heard on this show, and I'm sure you've heard elsewhere, is that people are worried about over-vaccinating, that there's too much of it going on.
Yeah, and I totally agree with that. And I look at vaccines for pets just as vaccines for humans, and that we have to look at lifestyle. And really, truly, for dogs and cats, their lifestyles differ. I mean, in the human world, we pretty much all do the same things. I mean, some of us may travel to areas where other diseases are, and some of us may have jobs that require us to be vaccinated. I would bet that if I took a poll, most people would say they've never been vaccinated for rabies, and yet I have, because I'm a veterinarian. And so looking at lifestyle is really important when it comes to vaccines. And so we break vaccines down in the veterinary world into something called core vaccines, and those are the ones that either are required by law, like rabies vaccine, and even an indoor pet needs to be vaccinated for rabies, because for dogs it's a state law, for cats it's not in the state laws, but it is a local ordinance. And, you know, it's for public health issues if your cat or dog were to bite somebody, or in our local ordinance, even scratch somebody, you have to be able to show proof of rabies. But we look at the core vaccines that are either the ones that are required by law, or like rabies, or cause severe disease, like dog distemper or parvovirus or cat panleukopenia. And then we look at what are called the non-core vaccines that are very lifestyle-type vaccines, where if the pet has had high risk, they may need to be vaccinated. And one thing that I like to do with owners, especially dog owners, because we have a lifestyle calculator calculator available to us, the American Animal Hospital Association vaccine guidelines for dogs that were published in 2017, have a nice little quiz that owners can do. And it kind of says, yeah, with things that you've answered, this would be something to talk to your veterinarian about, whether your dog needs this vaccine or not. And so to give you an example, we happen to live in the Madison area, in an area that has a very high prevalence of an infectious disease called leptospirosis, which is spread through urine of infected animals. And it's mainly our urban wildlife, things like rats, raccoons, deer, and so on, which are urbanized, and we have them around here. And so I think every dog that lives in this area needs to be vaccinated for lepto. But if you live someplace else in the country, it may not be an issue because it's too dry and may not be a problem. Lyme vaccine, another thing to consider. We live in a heavy tick area, and so Lyme vaccine for dogs that are high risk for ticks may be necessary. And so we tend to look at all those things. And so rather than just treating every dog or cat the same, we as veterinarians spend time learning about the lifestyle of our pets so that we can come up with the vaccination program that would be appropriate and not over-vaccinate our dogs or cats.
You know, I'm betting here we'll be talking to maybe 20 people on the air, and at least a few of them will say, well, I have an adopted dog. Uh-huh. And I'm wondering how that applies. If you get a dog that you don't know they've had the shots, do you go ahead and what do you do?
Though there's a couple of things we can do. Often we have to revaccinate for rabies. If you don't have current proof that your dog is current on a rabies vaccine, which would mean a vaccine certificate signed by a veterinarian with the vaccine information, the serial number, the tag number, and all that information. If we don't have that, we are obligated by law to revaccinate that dog for rabies vaccine, with rabies vaccine. The other diseases, you could potentially do something called titers, which is measuring a blood sample, the immunity in a blood sample. So we measure antibody levels in a blood sample, and that gives us an idea of if the dog has been exposed or been vaccinated before, or cat, if you want to do that, so that we can choose whether we need to vaccinate or not. Many people just choose to vaccinate for safety reasons, and because titer costs are often more expensive than vaccine cost. And so because vaccines have a very, very high safety record, often we just go ahead and give the vaccine and then get on a schedule that would be appropriate for that animal's lifestyle and age.
I'd never do it myself, but can vaccinations be done at home?
They can. And a few things, kind of words of warning. One, rabies, you can't. If you do manage to get a rabies vaccine and you give it to your pet at home and you're not a veterinarian, then even if you're a registered, licensed veterinary technician, unless that there is a veterinarian in the household with you when you give that vaccine, you cannot give rabies. It has to be done by a veterinarian or under the direct supervision of a veterinarian by a licensed technician. Or in the vet school, we have a pass for senior vet students as well to be able to do that. The other thing that we worry about is, has the vaccine been mixed and given appropriately? Some are meant to be given orally, some are in the nose, some are under the skin, some are in the muscle. And so knowing the right route of administration is really important. Was the vaccine stored correctly? We actually have a separate refrigerator that only vaccine gets stored in, and it's kept at a constant temperature. There's no vegetable drawers. There's nothing stored on the door and everything. So it's a very stable temperature with an alarm system in it. And even if the door gets left open a crack, an alarm will go off. And we have come back to work after a weekend and had to throw out an entire refrigerator, thousands of dollars worth of vaccine, because it shut off over the weekend for whatever reason. And so that's what I always worry about. Are those doses of vaccine that are delivered to your farm store that are being put in a refrigerator, have they been left on the loading dock too long? Is that refrigerator at the right temperature? So those are big considerations. And then the huge one, which thank goodness, I'm knocking on wood, doesn't happen very often, is those acute allergic reactions, where if I didn't have critical care down the hallway where I could carry a patient and have them do emergency post-vaccine allergic reaction care, we could potentially lose an animal. I've been a vet for almost 40 years now, and I can count on one hand the number of patients that's happened to. And yet when you look at the thousands of vaccines I've given over my career, very, very low number. All of those animals survived, but I needed to have those emergency drugs right there. And so if that happened at home,
you're
what could you
luck.
Do? I don't even vaccinate my pets at home. I take them into work for that very reason, because I couldn't get them to the emergency clinic in time.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. We'll take some calls and some emails now. Ron in Beulah, Michigan is up first. Hi, Ron.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure, what's on your mind?
I have a question about the leptospirosis vaccine for my 8-year-old black lab, Lila. And I thought a few years ago I'd heard Dr. Sandy say they should be given separately from the other vaccinations rather than in a combination. And I've just moved back into the state, and I've talked to a couple of different veterinarians, and one of them gives a 5-way vaccine, including leptospirosis, every year.
Okay.
And it seems to me that it would be better to go to a vet that just gave it this leptospirosis separately every year, and just did the parvo distemper vaccine every 3 years. And I wanted your best advice on that.
Well, what a great memory you have. I'm really, really impressed. And yes, that is a very, very good question. The problem we have is that the majority of those combination vaccines are viral. And then the leptospirosis is something that, being a Bacterin, needs to be given more frequently on an annual basis. But the distemper and parvo and adenovirus and parainfluenza, every 3 years is what is recommended for those vaccines. Of course, after you've given a series as a puppy, a year later, then we go every 3 years. And so by using that combo vaccine, you are over-vaccinating the dog. You're giving them viral components that they probably don't need. And so that's one concern. The other concern is that when we mix together in the syringe, and in this case, when we're using that combination vaccine, the leptospirosis ends up being in the diluent, and it gets mixed in with the viral components. There has been evidence that leads to an increased risk of allergic reaction in dogs. And so the recommendation is to give them, if you're going to be giving them at the same time, put them in separate locations. So we give the distemper parvo component over on the right shoulder, and we give the lepto on the left shoulder. And you can give them at the same time, but just not mixed together in the same syringe. And so that's my preference. It does mean an extra injection for the veterinarian to give and for the dog to receive, but I think it's safer in the long run.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Rachel in West Allis. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Dr. Sawchuk. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm calling about my 5.5-year-old spayed female. She was diagnosed with inflammatory bowel disease this past summer, and we've been managing it by long-term low-dose antibiotic Tylosin.
Mm-hmm.
And we switched her to the limited ingredient diet, so venison only, and then we've also done probiotics, and it doesn't seem to be helping much. She was diagnosed on symptoms alone, no testing, so basically she just has loose stools, not in frequency but consistency. Just anytime she goes, it's loose stools. And so, one, I'm concerned about the safety of long-term antibiotics. And two, I just don't know if it's actually inflammatory bowel disease or something else. So I'm just kind of looking for your perspective and how I should follow up with my vet.
Yeah, a couple of things. Inflammatory bowel disease is one of those things that we are very suspicious of when we have a cat with chronic diarrhea, and especially if we have some other things that go along with it. Often we will do some blood work, a GI panel, gastrointestinal panel, that has to be done fasted, and it goes off to a lab. I think the only one in the country that's doing it right now is Texas A&M. And so I'm wondering if that's been done for your cat. Because the fact that your cat's on Tylosin, that is usually used if they're suspicious of small intestinal bacterial overgrowth to help change the flora of the intestinal tract. The other thing that we see often affected that can cause continual chronic diarrhea in cats is low cobalamin. It's a B vitamin that we see low cobalamin levels in many cats with this type of intestinal disease need to be on cobalamin supplementation. And it's usually given as an injectable. We teach owners how to give it. It's now newly available in an oral form. The problem with the oral medication is all the research was done on animals with healthy intestines. So we don't know how well it really truly is absorbed. And so our internists at the vet school still kind of recommend if the owner doesn't mind giving these small volumes of B vitamins by injection, that we have you do that. And so if you haven't had that blood work done, by all means, ask your veterinarian to do that. Mm-hmm. You also mentioned that your cat is on a limited ingredient diet, and it's a venison diet. If it's an over-the-counter diet, it may not only have venison in it, and it may be contaminated with other protein sources. So we always recommend going with a trial of a hydrolyzed protein diet, one that the animal doesn't know where the proteins have come from. So that would be something to go back to if you haven't already done that. And lastly, if you really want to get a diagnosis, scoping and biopsies is the way to go. And so going in with an endoscope, having a look, obviously your cat has to be fasted and have be cleaned out, just like for a human that's going in for a gastrointestinal study, but getting biopsies done. Because the other thing that we will sometimes see in cats is a condition called gastrointestinal lymphoma, which it mimics the inflammatory bowel disease. And that's obviously treated very, very differently because it is a form of cancer. Yeah. And so we have to address it that way. So look into those things. And I think hopefully just getting that GI panel done, getting your cat on cobalamin, and maybe a hydrolyzed protein diet will get this your kitty feeling a lot better faster.
Good luck, Rachel. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today, our producer today, Jane Rotunda, engineer Dave Potratz. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining in. We'll go right back to our phones and to Bill in Black River Falls next. Bill, what's on your mind?
Yeah, good morning, Larry and Sandy. In your introduction, I know you're focusing on vaccinations today, but in your introductions, you said other questions, too, and I have another. If you don't want to take my call, I'll understand and call back on another show.
That's fine. Just go right ahead.
I have a question. I have a small toy poodle Maltese mix. As a matter of fact, he was picked up in Dane County as a stray, and he has a terrible tear-staining problem. He's all white, and his face just turns brown under his eyes from all that staining, and it cakes up, and I wash his face with a wash rag every day. I've gone on the Internet, and the products are very expensive, and they don't work, according to the comments. My groomer has no ideas, and maybe the doctor does.
Yeah, we see this all the time, and not only tear staining on the face, but saliva staining on feet for dogs that have allergies, where they're licking, because tears and saliva contain a chemical that, in reaction to light, turns that rusty brown color. So to get to the bottom of why you have all this tear staining, why is your dog tearing so much to begin with? And so that's what really needs to be focused on is it a matter of keeping the face clean of hair so that we don't have hair rubbing on the eyes? Do we have something wrong with the eye itself, like extra eyelashes that are rubbing on the surface of the eye that maybe aren't hurting the eye but are causing the dog to tear? Do we have plugged tear ducts that either the dog was born that way or due to chronic inflammation, they're scarred? And so the tears are now just overflowing down the face. Or is it a case like my dogs where I have bulldogs with their anatomy is such that everything is squished and with their face folds, they get the tearing down in their face folds as well. And so it comes down to daily maintenance. If you can't find an underlying cause, keeping the face, you know, just clean every single day. I mean, it may mean a couple of times a day using some of the medicated wipes that are safe to use around the eyes. The products that are on the market, yes, you're right. There's a number of them out there that are, you know, claimed to be effective, but we really don't see much efficacy. I think it's more the fact that the people are they've bought them and they're keeping the face clean to be able to stop some of the staining from occurring. There has been some reports of different probiotics. I don't know why it would work, but different probiotics that when given to a dog, owners have reported decrease in the tear staining. The dog may still be tearing, but we just don't see as much staining. So that might be something to consider. Although it's giving your dog something internally, it would be very, very safe to consider using. I don't know whether it's going to help or not, but again, this is just one of those random things that I've heard people say, and why not try it?
If
it helps.
Why not?
Because really, truly, it's cosmetic, and it's just, unfortunately, if your dog was a dark-colored dog, you wouldn't see the staining.
You wouldn't notice it. Dye your dog black. There you go.
No,
oh,
but
man.
You know, you don't want to do that because, you know, I know you said that in humor, but I have a colleague of mine many years ago had a black lab mix with yellow feet and yellow spots over its eyes, and she wanted the dog to be an all black lab. And I came into the clinic one time, and here she has the dog in the bathtub, and she's using human black hair dye on the feet to try to dye the dog black. And although it didn't irritate the skin or cause any trouble, the hair turned blue. And so the dog ended up walking around with blue feet and blue dots over its eyes, which I would have been very hesitant to do that. But that's, yeah, you can't use human hair dye on pets and expect it to, one, be safe and turn out like humans.
All right. There you go, Bill. Thank you so much for calling. Susie emailed, she's got a 5-pound dog. Every time she has an immunization or gives a heartworm pill, the dog seems to get sick. It seems to me that giving a 5-pound dog the same dose as you give a 25-pound dog is going to cause problems. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, an immune system is an immune system is an immune system, regardless of whether it's in a 5-pound dog or a Great Dane-sized dog. So we have to dose with the concentration that's in the vial. So we don't split doses. What we do for small dogs, though, is we often limit the number of vaccines that we give at one setting. So we may have the dog get a rabies vaccine on one visit, and then a minimum of 2 weeks between vaccine episodes, give another vaccine. So rather than doing them all at once, we separate them out. This would also be the case where she may want to look into having blood samples done for vaccine titers so that she can know that her dog is protected and only vaccinate her dog for what she needs to be vaccinated for. So again, we're not over-vaccinating. And if we've had an issue with vaccine reactions where the dog has broken out into hives or gotten deathly ill, sometimes we just have to not vaccinate because of the fact that it can be life-threatening for the dog. So mild reactions, we may be able to pre-treat with some antihistamines and that type of thing. When it comes to heartworm preventions, there are some heartworm preventatives out there now that are sized for dogs that are 10 pounds and under. And so looking for one of the brands that is for the very small dogs, and it may mean that if your veterinarian doesn't carry that particular brand, you may have to order it through a veterinary online pharmacy to be able to get the appropriate drug for your dog. But we don't want to avoid having your dog on heartworm preventative because the result of your dog getting heartworm would be absolutely horrible for your dog.
Yeah. She also wondered, you know, with that small dog, teeth cleaning with the vet where anesthesia might be used, can that create problems? And could she just brush her dog's teeth every day?
brushing dog's teeth, by all means, very, very important. But if the dog already has periodontal disease and visible tartar, brushing is not going to remove that. In fact, it may cause the dog to resent having that toothbrush put in the mouth because it hurts. And so having a good thorough oral exam done while the dog is awake in for a wellness appointment, because, you know, we can assess what's going on in the mouth while they're awake to a degree. Often we're really surprised once we get in there and the dog's asleep and we can start probing, taking x-rays to see what's going on. The little dogs tend to be more prone to periodontal disease. They don't have as much bone structure holding their teeth in place just because of their size. And so a little bit of periodontal disease causes significant changes for dogs, which is why we see many Chihuahuas and poodles and so on going toothless as they get older. And so getting your dog in for an anesthetized dental, a conscious dental, you cannot do safely. You run the risk of injuring the dog. It's painful for the dog. You can't do a thorough cleaning. You can't do extractions. So it's much safer and more complete to do it under anesthesia.
Let's go to Vivian in Green Bay now. Vivian, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
I have a 3-year-old female, stepped out of the woods, so I'm thinking she was 18 months at that point.
Now it's a kitty, right? A cat,
oh,
right?
Cat.
Yeah.
A female cat. Yeah. She was pregnant. I've kept her and one of her kittens, but she appears to have developed a heart murmur. It was not picked up early on. And my vet, who I think is one of your former students, Dr. Fulgioni in Green Bay.
Mm-hmm.
So he's upset by the degree of the heart murmur. So an echocardiogram has been scheduled. And the thought is, has a heartworm settled in there, or more than one?
Yeah.
And if so, what does one do about diagnosed heartworm?
Well, we're going to kind of address this two ways. First of all, cats can get heartworm. It is not at the same rate that dogs get it. Most cats that get heartworm don't have the same type of disease symptoms that dogs have. Sometimes it results in sudden death. If we do have any worms in the heart, rarely is it going to result in them having a heart murmur. Often they only have one worm, but that may be enough to cause them to get extremely ill. Usually we see more respiratory type diseases, and it's in fact it's given the initials HARD, heartworm acquired respiratory disease in cats, and so that would not be on the top of my rule out list for a cat that's living here in Wisconsin. But I would be looking for other things like cardiomyopathy, a heart muscle problem, congenital heart problems that may have been missed. And so those are things that need to be looked at, the heart muscle, to see how thick or thin it is, how well it's functioning, because many of these cats, with the appropriate therapy, can go on to lead a very normal life for a long time. It is important to get a diagnosis. Just because you hear a murmur, you can't grade the severity of the disease by the severity of the murmur. And so your cat may have a loud murmur, but really not that bad disease, or it could be vice versa. So get that echocardiogram done. Get chest rads done at the same time so that the radiographs will look at the shadow of the heart and how big it is, and also look at the lung field, which is something that we would want to be paying attention to if heartworm is on our list of differentials. And have your veterinarian do a heartworm test on your cat. There's two types of heartworm tests that we do in cats. One that actually looks for proteins from the adult female worms, and then also an antibody test, which indicates exposure. So it's tested a little bit differently than dogs.
There you go, Vivian. Thank you so much for calling in. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Sam and Delavan will turn to you next. Hi, Sam.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I am later this week picking up a 9-week-old Australian cattle dog, and she was a member of an 11-puppy litter. and she's kind of a runt, and I'm wondering if there's anything I can do as far as diet or supplements or anything like that, just to make sure that she's going to get develop as much size as she should.
The first thing I would do is have this puppy evaluated by your veterinarian to make sure that there isn't a health reason why she didn't grow properly like her litter mates. 11 puppies is huge for a dog to have, and considering that they usually only have like 8 to maybe 10 nipples, but 8 typically, you know, if she was small for some other reason, like maybe congenital heart problems or a liver shunt or something like that, those would be things that we'd want to get off the table. First of all, and if the puppy is healthy and happy, then just being in an environment where it's going to be able to eat and thrive without the stress of having a lot of other dogs around pushing her or him out of the way, I think your dog will do just fine. And most dogs that are considered the runt of the litter often catch up and sometimes even surpass their litter mates once they're in individual homes.
There you go. Good luck, Sam. Thanks very much for calling. And Madeline and DePere will go to you next. Hi, Madeline.
Hello. I had a friend who had a dog that became ill, and before it died, it had oozing sores all over its body. It was kind of a short-haired dog. I think it might have been a pug dog. And it's a very sweet dog. But anyway, what kind of disease causes that? Is it Lyme disease, or is there other diseases that causes that kind of a symptom?
Well, this is really a hard one to answer without actually seeing the dog. The few things that come to mind that can cause, you know, horrible disease and death that can cause skin sores. One, because we live in Wisconsin, the fungal infection called blastomycosis, which can cause draining tracts and can be, without treatment, a fatal disease. There are other autoimmune diseases that can cause crusting and sores all over the body, like lupus, and there's a number of other things like that that can affect the kidneys and other organs in the body too, and can really, without proper treatment, cause the pet to not be able to live a normal life. And then there's different cancers. There's a type of cancer called mycosis fungoides, also known as cutaneous lymphoma, that without treatment and even with treatment is eventually fatal. So when we have a dog that's like this, often if we can't get an answer by collecting samples directly from the sores on the body, we are often required to get little biopsies to be able to have a better idea of what may be going on. I'm very sorry that your friend lost the dog. And I know that, you know, this is where, although it's sometimes a little bit difficult to think about, having an autopsy done, or in the veterinary world we call them a necropsy, done on the pet often helps with closure, so that questions like this don't continue to haunt you. What could we have done differently? And so I always advise people, you know, get that done if possible, because it will help you with knowing that you've done everything that you could for your pet.
Very good advice. Thank you, Madeline, for calling. Linda in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Linda. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I so enjoy this portion of the program. I am calling. We have a Bichon Papillon Mix. She's 14 years old, and her skin coloring is turning darker, and she is losing hair. We've recently, it's probably been within the last 6 months, she has had a history of bladder stones, and she was put on Stilbestrol, 1 milligram daily. Could that be the cause?
That's
an estrogen, she's using it daily.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, usually when we're using diethylstilbestrol, It's given on a very limited schedule, often daily for the first few days, and it's usually used to help with incontinence. If we have a dog that is leaking urine because their bladder sphincter isn't tight enough and there's no underlying reason for them to be leaking other than just being a spayed female or a weak bladder sphincter, and we after they've been on DES for a few days, usually 5 to 7 days, we get down to maybe once a week. We don't use it on a daily basis. And so I'd be looking into that. I don't know if that's what's causing your dog to have its hair loss or not, but being a 14-year-old dog, other things that I'd be worried about would be things like Cushing's disease, which can cause hair loss and, you know, pigment changes in the skin. It's an overactive adrenal gland, and often they'll be drinking more and urinating more. So an older dog with skin changes, often we're looking at having to get some blood work done, and I would definitely be recommending that. If you are using an estrogen on a daily basis, the risk of having your dog develop anemia, which can sometimes be irreversible, is really high. So get your dog in for a complete blood cell count, which is required when we have dogs on DES, as well as getting some chemistry done to see if there's any markers for some of these other things that could be causing hair loss in the senior patient.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling, Linda. And soon in Racine, we go to you next. Hi.
Yes. Hi. How are you?
Good. I appreciate
your
call.
I'm so honored to talk to you guys.
Well, it's glad to have you with us.
Thank you. And I'm calling to, because I have a Yorkie, and he's 12 years old. And he's having an issue for his private, and he kept licking. So I took him to the vet, and he did that before little vet, and they gave him antibiotic, and he said he didn't do it. But this time he's really licking, so we took him in, they look at it, and they say he doesn't have a really infection, so they give him, but they give him antibiotic. He took it, and he seems like getting a little better, but since I've done the antibiotic, a couple of days later, he started leaking again. So this is the second time he got antibiotic, and he's, you know, kind of leak and not leak, so I put him diaper on. And so I say, you know, why don't we send to lab, see what he have. So we did, and they come back and negative. And so now what should I do?
Male dogs that are licking at their prepuce will often, I mean, we do see infections of the prepucial area. And so sometimes we, rather than just treating systemically with an antibiotic, sometimes we have to treat topically, and it may require going in there and flushing the sheath out, because we sometimes will see hair stuck in there and other material. And so if your veterinarian has not actually prolapsed the penis and had a look inside the sheath to rule out things like tumors or foreign material, that really needs to be done, because I really worry about infections coming back over and over again, that there might be some underlying cause that's triggering this. If your dog, I'd be also looking at, does your dog have prostate disease, doing a rectal exam, and making sure that your dog, if he's not neutered, be neutered as well, because sometimes we will see, you know, hormonal changes will, again, being a boy dog, if he's constantly getting an erection, that could be causing him to get irritated and cause the licking too. So number of things to be thinking about, but I think the big thing is what's the underlying cause. We've got to get in there and have a look. May require him to be sedated to be able to get up in there and have a good peek around.
Good luck. Thank you, Soon, for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at your pet's health today here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Always great to have her come by. She comes by once a month. Next month, it'll be March 26th. But she's here right now and ready to take your questions. And we'll go back to our phones, and let's go to Dave in Chippewa Falls, I believe, is next. Hi, Dave.
Hello. My question is regarding my 7.5-year-old Norwegian Elkhound, healthy, active, up to date on all shots and spayed. About 6 to 8 months ago, when he had antibiotics, and I forget why it was, we noticed a lump under his front leg, like an armpit kind of thing, a small lump, maybe the size of a quarter inch or something, a soft lump. And we've been monitoring that. It's grown a little bit bigger. He doesn't mind us when we're checking it. I wonder if we should monitor it and wait to see if it gets larger or be proactive in some other regard. So I'd like your advice on that, please.
I think any new lump that is found should be checked out by doing a needle biopsy, actually putting a little needle in it, getting some of the cells out, and looking under the microscope. I give you an example. One of my friends that has another veterinarian that she goes to, one of her dogs had two lumps. They're like, oh, they're probably just fatty lumps, nothing to worry about, just watch them. And she's been watching them for, oh, good, probably 6 to 8 months. And out of curiosity, I made a house call and I did a needle biopsy, and they both came back as a type of cancer called a mast cell tumor, which is not something you want to let sit on the dog's body. And although the masses felt rather benign, you can't tell until you actually look at the masses. So I would be thinking that getting a visit through your veterinarian is going to make you stop worrying. If it comes down to being just a benign fatty growth or a small cyst or something, then you can just be monitoring it and know that it's not cancer, it's nothing to worry about. But if it is something more serious, catching it early, very important. It's an easy procedure. We do it awake. We use a needle that's the same size as that we give vaccines with, but we just take some of the cells out of the mass, look at it on a slide. For the majority of masses, many veterinarians can just look at them themselves and be able to come up with a diagnosis. For others, if there's some question, we send it off for a lab to look at it so that we can get a better answer, so that we can just plan our treatment to be a little more effective.
There you go, Dave. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Kate in Menasha, we'll go to you next. Hi, Kate.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I have a 6-year-old mixed breed male dog. His name is Chipper. And I finally settled on a diagnosis of irritable bowel in Chip. And with my vet, who's been very helpful, I now have him on prednisolone, metronidazole, Serenia as needed, daily Pepcid, and a probiotic. And I think it's moderating or mediating the disease, but other than looking for a support group for pet owners, I wonder, is there anything else that I could be doing for him? Obviously diet as well. I've changed his diet.
What did you change his diet to?
Well, he cannot eat rice, which I found early in his life was a trigger for episodes. So that really limits what I can feed him right now. He gets boiled potatoes and boiled beef when he's having a flare-up. And then I have experimented over long periods of time and found a grain-free kibble that he seems to tolerate fairly well. Unfortunately, the hydrolyzed protein diet that I tried for him a few years ago, believe it or not, it made it worse. And I don't know if that's because the first ingredient was a rice.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, so he gets boiled potatoes and boiled lean beef, and then we work in kibble over the course of 2 weeks.
Okay. Yeah, one, the diet isn't balanced. There's no minerals or anything like that in it. And so long-term use on a diet like that's going to be hard on your dog nutritionally. The other thing that I worry about is long-term use of both prednisone and metronidazole. Prednisone, long-term use can suppress the immune system, affect the adrenal glands, affect the liver. And so you've got to be really careful with using that. And there are other kind of steroid-type drugs that might be a little bit safer that can be used long-term other than prednisone, but that would be something to be checking with your veterinarian. I don't know if what other diagnostic work has been done, but I think that if you've not jumped through the hoop of having some diagnostics done, that would be really important. Number one would be getting this fasted gastrointestinal panel done. I mentioned it to a cat owner earlier in the show. It's sent off to Texas A&M University. And what we're looking at is cobalamin levels and folate levels, because many dogs with inflammatory bowel disease will have a cobalamin deficiency and need to be put on cobalamin supplementation. It's a B vitamin that is, you know, often very significantly affected when we have IBD, and we have to supplement that, and that will often turn the diarrhea issues around. We will sometimes see some of these dogs have actually a pancreatic problem where they're not making enough enzymes to digest their food, and that's another thing that's looked at as well. So I think that would be something to be done. Once that's done and you get the results back, then you also want to maybe potentially be looking at a referral to a gastroenterologist, a veterinarian that specializes in that type of disease issues for dogs. They would likely be recommending scoping and getting some biopsies done, because if your dog is young and to have a lifetime ahead of them and you of being having to be on medications and special diets, there may be other answers that will help with getting some biopsies done. But the long-term metronidazole, even using it at very low levels, there have been reports of dogs developing the neurologic complications with using that particular drug. So again, even though it's an antibiotic for the gut, a long-term safety, I think for short-term use, yes, it's great. Long-term use, I really question that's the appropriate thing to use for your dog. And, you know, don't give up on the diet either. There are now many different veterinary nutritionists that do homemade diets that would be potentially without the offending ingredients that would be affecting your dog. And I don't think with just trying one hydrolyzed protein diet, you've probably given your dog a chance to see if they respond to that. Talk to your veterinarian. It may mean ordering something else through some of the other online pet food suppliers if your vet doesn't carry it. Another trial of a hydrolyzed protein diet I really think is in order.
There you go, Kate. Thank you again for calling. Well, we'll go to Jim in Poinette next. Hi, Jim.
Howdy do.
Thanks for joining us. What's on your mind?
Well, I've got we rescued a Maltese poodle combination a couple of years ago. And she's about probably 10 to 12 years old. Lost the hair on her ears. And so she's got little pink wings sticking out there. Crusty margins sometimes, and sometimes she scratches at it. But we've been treated for mange, done antibiotics, and Benadryl cream, that sort of thing. So far.
Yeah. What did you treat her for mange with?
That did it. I don't recall what the chemical was.
Okay. We're really lucky right now, because with all the oral flea and tick products that are on the market, Bravecto, NexGard, Simparica, Credelio, those are all very effective for controlling some of the mites that we see. And there is a mite in particular that likes to affect the ear margin, makes them very itchy, and it's called Cercoptes. And so that would be something to get, be checking for. We do skin scrapings to rule that out, but sometimes it's response to therapy. And with these prescription drugs that are very effective, that would be something we'd consider using. The other things that I get concerned about would be, does your dog have some type of vasculitis? Sometimes the ears having very tiny blood vessels, we will get some marginal crusting and hair loss, and that could potentially be going on as well. And, you know, to be honest with you, how we treat that, often it's triggered by some type of outside event, like a vaccination being given. Again, very rare, but it may be something like that happening. And so talking to your veterinarian, this might be something to consider even biopsying.
Yeah, it'd be worth a try. Yeah. Jim, thank you. Good luck. Thanks for calling. Carol in Oak Creek, your turn.
Hi. Yes, I have a vaccine question and a health issue. I have a cat who's 15 years old. I adopted her as a senior when she was only, so that was only about a year and a half ago. She frequently has respiratory issues. She gets a deep cough, runny nose. The vet is not sure if it's asthma or a cold. The blood tests are okay, no problems he can't detect in the lungs. But every 2 or 3 months, her nose gets so stuffy and a bad cough that she needs an antibiotic shot that lasts 2 weeks. The symptoms aside, and periodically I have to give her prednisone for her cold-like symptoms. So the cough never really goes away. It gets better, and the runny nose does go away for a while until the next episode. So her health seems delicate, and she is due for vaccines, but are there any vaccines I should avoid in such an elderly cat with health issues? Because I'm worried about vaccinating her. And do you have any advice for the respiratory issues?
Well, you know, I think that the respiratory issues, boy, short of going through the respiratory extravaganza, scoping and getting, you know, a look up in there, a CT scan to be able to determine what's going on, an antibiotic responsive thing could be because she's had an old viral infection that's caused a lot of damage. It may be a recrudescence of a herpes virus that is causing this. But we never want to vaccinate a cat when they're sick. So we always want to make sure that they're healthy at the time of vaccinating. So I think the core vaccines would be necessary, but only do it when she's feeling good.
Only do it when she's feeling good, Carol. Thank you so much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, will be with us right up until 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back with Dr. Sandy. You stay with us. Looking at your pet's health here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, my guest today, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her back, and thank you so much for listening in. Excuse me. And we'll take some calls right out of the chute here and go to Ryan in Kokana first. Hi, Ryan.
Hello, how are you?
Appreciate the call.
Good. My question is, I have a going on 11-year-old. It's a Rhodesian Ridgeback mixed breed. He looks just like a Ridgeback, only he's actually missing the physical stripe. Basically, just through some routine blood work, they found his liver counts, and I want to say it's AST. Does that sound right?
ALT and yeah. AST. Yes. Okay.
Okay. Yeah, they were elevated. And this is back in say December, early December. And I want to say they said like normal was around 100 and was at the time around 200. And now even we've tried like an antibiotic, tried some expensive supplement and neither one did anything with the counts. It's now, and it keeps going up. He's now was actually up over 400, a few weeks ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
My normal vet suggested doing a ultrasound at I'm in Kokana, so at the referral center here in Appleton.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what I'm wondering is that sound right to address it this way? And if I do this, does finding, you know, whether they find something or they don't find something, does that actually change how we go about it? You know, I mean, what would be a best and worst case scenario? I mean, I don't mind spending the money on them, but if we're not going to do anything after the ultrasound,
What's the point?
Yeah, and I assume your dog's feeling good, right?
No other symptoms.
No other symptoms.
Only thing was just routine blood check once a year. That's
okay.
The only thing.
Yeah. I mean, these things happen all the time where we've got a normal patient that comes in. We're just like, hey, they're senior. Let's get some blood work. And it's like, oh, here we have an abnormality. What do we do about it? And I think your veterinarian's done the right thing. That initial evaluation, those particular liver values that you're talking about are actually enzymes that come from liver cells. So that's telling us that there's some liver cell leakage for some reason. It doesn't tell us why, but just kind of puts it in that, yeah, there's something wrong with the liver cells. There's a couple of other things that we look at that may involve the bile system in the liver, and so sometimes those values will be up, and then we may address it a little bit differently. But I would have probably done exactly the same thing. Say, you know, let's try them on a liver support agent. There's one that we use called Denimarin, which is a milk thistle SAMe supplement for dogs. And we try it usually if the dog's feeling good for 30 days. If we get them back in, we recheck the values. If nothing's changed or it's going up, then we consider jumping to the next level, and that next level is having an abdominal ultrasound done. What we'd be looking for is areas in the liver that are abnormal, like do we have some type of a liver cancer going on? I had a dog in not too long ago that had, you know, pretty elevated liver value that kept going up. We finally ultrasounded it, had a single solitary liver mass. Surgery, it was successful, and the dog is going to go on and has lived for the last couple of years a very normal life for a senior dog. So sometimes we find something like that. Other times we'll find, you know, that it is maybe not the best news, but depending on the, you know, if we do find that there is cancer there, some of them respond very well to chemotherapy and we can go down that path. Other times we will find bacterial infections that may need certain types of treatment. If we find, you know, that the gallbladder or something's bigger and we can get some samples of that. So, it really depends on what is found and if biopsying can be done safely under ultrasound. But that's the kind of the path that you would have to take. It's hard for me to say which way for you to go, because it may be that you're having a look in there and you may find absolutely nothing, which we find in the majority of cases.
Boy.
And now we're just dealing with a dog with a number that is feeling good. And we just, you know, say, well, let's just watch and see what happens. But other times, you know, we get not so good news. So I, at this point would say, you know, it's up to you, since your dog's feeling good. But I, being a pet owner myself, would say getting that ultrasound done is a safe, non-invasive thing to do that is going to give you more information going forward.
There you go.
I'd vote for that.
Me too. Thanks, Ryan. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Mary Jo in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Mary Jo.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Okay. First, I'd like to give a quick shout-out to my long-lost cousin Bill in Black River Falls. I just heard him with a question. My question is, my dog was recently diagnosed with diabetes, and I'm wondering if there's a diet you would recommend. I do have her because of she was at the referral vet. I'm giving her a gastrointestinal canned dog food, and then I think it's called UM by Purina, or something to help control her weight. But
okay.
If you could suggest if that's okay, or suggest something else, and then also if there's a way to hold off the blindness that I hear they usually get when they have diabetes.
Well, the number one way of controlling the blindness is control the diabetes, which is often meaning that you need to treat with insulin. Dogs that are diabetic do not respond. Typically are type 1 diabetics. Unlike people that can go on an oral medication, we just don't see that happening with dogs. So diet alone is not going to solve your dog's problem, but the diet we usually recommend is a diet that is a higher fiber diet to slow that gut motility down. I just was talking about this with a colleague, and Nestle Purina now has an enteric diet, which is a low-fat, easy-to-digest diet with extra fiber in it, and it's a higher fiber, low-fat diet, which would be very appropriate for your dog to go on. So that might be something to talk to your veterinarian about. But If you haven't had your dog started on insulin yet, that is going to be your best bet to prevent those cataracts from forming. And it's unfortunate that even a dog that's fairly well regulated can still end up with those secondary cataracts that may need to be removed to improve your dog's quality of life.
There you go, Mary Jo. Thank you so much for calling. And I want to give Dick in Oak Creek a chance to join in with a question about cats.
Hi there.
Hi.
True or false, milk is not good for cats to drink.
It really depends on the cat. Well, number one, if they were just drinking milk, it would not be a complete and balanced diet. And if they're drinking that and avoiding eating, then again, you're not letting them get the proper nutrients that they need. Many cats are lactose intolerant, and so just like with people that are lactose intolerant, it can result in messes in the litter box. So we, you know, would avoid feeding milk to cats like that. But with that said, if you've got a cat that tolerates milk, that little bit left over in the bottom of your cereal bowl and the cat wants to lick it up, I'm hard-pressed to say don't do it. But if it upsets the cat's stomach or your cat is overweight and doesn't need those extra calories, then obviously avoid using it. But it shouldn't be part of their diet every day.
There you go, Dick. Thank you so much for calling. Speaking of nutrition, Sandy emailed and wondered if you knew anything about Nutra Thrive. It's called. It's from a company called Ultimate Pet Nutrition. She says, I added about a half a teaspoon to my dog's food. I'm not sure if I've noticed much difference in him, but he certainly loves it.
Well, the reason why he loves it is because it's bacon flavored.
Yeah.
And so, bacon makes everything better. So, but that's that. What it is it's basically a probiotic with some added vitamins and things in it, too. So is it going to help your dog? Yeah, maybe, maybe not. Is it going to hurt them? Not at all. Is it make them like their food? By all means, yes. I mean, a lot of the probiotics are flavored and act as an appetite stimulant. So feel free to use it. It is made by a company that is owned by a veterinarian who is not a veterinary nutritionist, but he markets products like this. So again, you know, it's not something that every dog needs to be on. Is it going to hurt them? No. It looks like it's pretty pricey. So
yeah.
I'd be...
Expensive bacon flavor.
Yeah. But I'm not advocating putting bacon on your dog's food, okay? Because that high fat's really going to interfere with their digestion and can result in pancreatitis and diarrhea and all kinds of other problems.
Kim and Muskego, on to you. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Larry and Dr. Sawchuk. Thank you for taking my question.
You're welcome.
I have a 5-year-old dachshund who weighs about 18 pounds, and he has never been a happy rider in any vehicle from when he was a puppy at 10 weeks, and we picked him up. He throws up occasionally, but mostly he just freezes in a laying position and looks really, really unhappy and is kind of nauseous, I think is what his main problem is, that he's nauseous. We always make sure we take him for a little walk before we take him in the car. We make sure that he's been able to use toilet. And we have tried the half a tablet of Benadryl that our vet recommended, but I was wondering if you had any other good recommendations for medication or possibly tips and ideas for him to be able to drive easier.
Yeah, there is a medication that's available by prescription through your veterinarian that we use for vomiting and nausea in dogs. And it's called Serenia. And it's a drug that you have to give at a much higher dose than we use for a dog that's just ill for other reasons. For motion sickness, it's used at about 4 times the dose that we would typically use in the hospital with just an ill patient. You have to give it a couple hours on an empty stomach. stomach before you travel, and it lasts for 24 hours, and it's not sedating, which is nice. So that would be something to consider trying. The Benadryl as an antihistamine for stopping, you know, vomiting in the car isn't great. If you really want to use an antihistamine that is going to be more specifically directed at the vomiting center in the brain, I would probably try Dramamine, which is diphenhydramate. I think it's a different type of antihistamine. And, you know, it's Dramamine's available over the counter. I don't know the dose for dogs. I'd have to look it up as an over the counter drug. But that, again, would be something that you could give. But just like it does for people, it can be sedating for the dog. So that's why I like Serenia, because your dog can ride and get out of the car and be comfortable. The other thing that I worry about is how much of this is just nerves for the dog. And if your dog is uncomfortable and fearful of driving, that could result in the dog being, you know, freezing and not wanting to move. It may not be all nausea. And so that may come down to desensitizing your dog to going for car rides, which means just going out and sitting in the car and reading the paper and then maybe backing out of the driveway and, you know, just very, very short trips where the dog is in a situation where it's not going to be tossed around the car, maybe in a crate or seat belted in. So it's facing forward. It's, you know, not able to be, you know, bouncing around in the car. Sometimes that helps. Sometimes being in a crate with a cover over it makes the dog feel better. Being in the middle of the car rather than in the back hatch, that may make the dog feel better as well. So we do try some kind of positional things as well, but I would bet that your dog's going to do really well if it's just nausea related on this drug called Serenia. So talk to your veterinarian about that.
There you go, Kim. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's take another call and go to Michael in La Crosse. Hi, Michael. Michael, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I have an 18-year-old male cat, and it seems in the last few months his dementia has taken hold, and I was just wondering any suggestions about that. He's not himself, and he also is very arthritic, so I was wondering if there's any suggestions about that.
Yeah, we're really limited with things that we can use for cats with arthritis because there's pain medications that we can use that can affect the kidneys. And, you know, so the typical drugs that we would use in dogs, we have to be very careful with using in cats. But there are some other pain medications at lower levels like gabapentin and buprenorphine given sublingually that can really help with making them feel better. Usually we'd want to make sure that there's no other underlying problems like kidney disease or hyperthyroidism that we need to be addressing. So getting some blood work done ahead of time before starting your cat on anything would be helpful. Regarding the dementia, I mean, there's only one licensed drug for dementia that's a prescription drug, and it's only labeled for dogs. It's not labeled for cats. There are some over-the-counter things that we can use, like Senolife and Nutrix, and there's, you know, things like that that are supposedly helpful for you know, the brain as dogs and cats get older. So is it going to hurt your cat? No. Is it going to help? Maybe. Often what we do, simple things like multiple litter boxes, leaving lights on, keeping the schedule the same, trying to provide an enriched environment so that when the cat is awake, it has things to be focusing on and using its brain. Those would be all things that are going to, again, help your cat. But eventually it comes down to, you know, if your cat's wandering at night and keeping you awake, you may have to isolate your cat in a room so that everybody can get some sleep and your cat's, you know, not distressed by getting lost someplace else in the house. It's a really hard situation to be in when they get to be that point.
Yeah, that's too bad. Michael, thank you so much, and good luck with your kitty. Anthony and Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a 4.5-year-old dog, mixed breed dog, that has been diagnosed with idiopathic epilepsy. about a year and a half ago, and she was on Keppra, extended release Keppra, for about the first year. And she was put on that after a cluster of seizures. And then recently she's had an even worse cluster of seizures. So now she's on a higher dose of Keppra and zanisamide. And I'm wondering, these seem to be working, but we've only been off that on this new mix of medicines for about 2 weeks. But I'm wondering if diet or anything else we could be doing in addition to these medicines, because they seem to be, you know, getting bigger and bigger, the amounts that she has to take. We could do to possibly help her with these seizures.
Yeah, there is a new diet. Well, it's been on the market now for over a year. That it's a prescription diet that Nestle Purina makes, and it's called the NC diet. It's the NeuroCare diet, and it's a diet that is you would just feed as a regular diet to your dog, and it's got high levels of triglyceride oil and, you know, other nutrients and things, and it's supposedly, with the fatty acid levels, has been helpful with reducing seizures and keeping dogs from having to go up to higher and higher doses of anticonvulsant drugs. One of the other things that's really interesting, and you may want to look into this as well, the vet school in Madison isn't doing any research on it, but Colorado State University is, and it's using CBD oil for seizure control. And the company, I can't remember which company they're using, but it's either a company called Elevet, E-L-L-E-V-E-T, or there's another one called ABSC is the company, and I think it's the ABSC. You know what you're getting in the bottle, very well regulated. You have to use it at a much higher dose than what would be used for arthritis and things like that. I think it's 5 milligrams per kilogram is what Colorado's using, but that would be an area that you may want to look into. But I'd make sure that you're using, you know, one of the products that's actually being used with this testing. And between Cornell University and Colorado, they're both looking into that, and that may be helpful for your dog as well.
Thank you very much, Anthony, for calling. Are you seeing other uses for these kinds of oils?
Yeah, I mean, probably the big thing is dealing with arthritis and then seizure control. And again, we're really in the infancy stage of using these things and figuring out dosages. And there are so many products on the market. And my big concern is, are you getting the dose that your dog needs? And we know that the dosages vary, and the you know, amount that you're getting in the product is, you know, all over the place. And so staying with a company that veterinarians are actually working with, and it can be quite expensive to be able to use it. I just looked into it for my own dog that has some elbow arthritis, and it would run for me about $180 for a 3-month supply, which when you look at using other drugs like the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, that's about a wash, and I don't know if I'd ever be able to pull them off of it. But again, it's one of those things where it's probably not going to hurt them. It's still, you know, in the research phase, but I think that since it's, you know, available and fairly safe to use, why not give it a try?
Dawn from Wausau wants to make her cat's food. There are nutritional needs beyond the muscle of meat. Do you recommend any products which could be added to ground muscle meat to provide for the full nutritional needs for the kitty?
Yes, there's a couple of companies out there, and I always recommend working with a veterinary nutritionist, and you can find that out online with their website, the American Society of Veterinary Nutritionists. But the company that I typically use is one that's based in California called Balance It, and they have a supplement that you add to the meat, and usually there's a carbohydrate source as well, and lots of recipes, and that would be probably my place that I would send this owner to have a look and see.
All right. And on that note, we are out of time, Dr. Sandy. Thank you so much.
You are welcome.
You'll be back March 26th, and we'll do it all over again. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her here, and she's back March 26th. Tomorrow at 11, we'll talk about the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin And then at 11:45, take a look at Wisconsin Caves, a great update on a book that I'm finding fascinating. In the meantime, hey, thanks for listening, but please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.